right, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Fulton.
May it please the court. On this appeal, the district court did not abuse its discretion in refusing to hold a hearing on the issue of premature jury deliberations. There was no indication at all from the jury's notes that any member of the jury had concluded prematurely that any defendant was guilty. There was no indication that anybody had made up their minds or any of the perils that premature deliberations might pose. The jury notes indicated that whatever might have taken place was pretty limited when the judge first found out about it the second day of trial. The judge appropriately instructed the jury, don't make up your minds yet, keep an open mind. You'll have time for that later, basically. And when the judge found out about it, after the verdict on the guilt or innocence phase had taken place, the note that came in that day didn't add anything to the mix. There was no indication of any external influence, for example, that would have required a further inquiry. So we think that the judge appropriately handled this, refused to have a hearing, and that ought to be affirmed on appeal.
Are you making a merits argument or a 606B argument?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you making a merits argument or a 606B argument?
Well, both.
I didn't hear the latter.
Well, and it was also prohibited by Rule 606B from inquiry. I mean, that, as Your Honor pointed out in my opponent's argument, that's precisely the purpose of Rule 606B. And while he suggested that there was no authority that would prohibit such an inquiry, we think that the Supreme Court case of Tanner covers this issue and is the answer to that. In fact, the authority is contrary. So leaving that issue, Mr. Camarena argues with regard to Mr. Morales that the evidence of his previous incarceration there was error and there was prejudice and requires a retrial. Whatever error might have taken place with Mr. Morales and the evidence of his previous incarceration, it was for a delivery of marijuana conviction. That was overwhelmingly harmless. That evidence came out during the course of the introduction of Mr. Morales' confession to his involvement in this gang, his confession to knowing the rules, his statement that he was aware that there was a standing order to kill opposition gang members. Morales was, as I recall, a senior member of the gang, recalled to junior status. Of course, that took place at length and in great detail on audio tape. Mr. Morales, after his demotion, so to speak, to junior status, became the junior enforcer of the gang. And junior enforcer was the one who was basically responsible for assigning missions and supervising the commission of shootings and attempted murders, essentially. Morales was intimately involved in this gang for a long time, had a position of responsibility, confessed to that. The evidence was absolutely overwhelming. And the fact that the jury was not, I think we can conclude that the jury was not unduly prejudiced by the introduction of his previous marijuana conviction because the jury acquitted Morales of one of the counts in the indictment against him. The jury was not blinded by his previous incarceration for some reason. They acquitted him, I believe, of count 4 of the indictment.
That was not a drug-related count, right?
Count 4 was not a drug-related count. That's right. It might be easier if it was, but it wasn't.
Right. Your argument would be better if it was.
With regard to Mr. Rodriguez, and Mr. Hernandez on the sufficiency of the evidence as to count 9, the drug conspiracy. Of course, we recognize that mere association is not sufficient proof. Membership in a gang is not sufficient proof of a narcotics conspiracy. And the jury was instructed on that, that membership in the Insane Deuces was not the same as guilt on the charges of the indictment. The evidence, though, was far from mere association. Rodriguez and Hernandez did not blunder into these meetings from off the street. They were there because they were integral parts of this Insane Deuce gang and had been for a long time. Rodriguez had previously held positions of responsibility in the gang. Rodriguez had, I believe, assisted with the writing of the gang's constitution, so to speak, its rules and laws. Rodriguez and Hernandez both had long associations with the gang, membership in the gang, associated in the gang. They attended these meetings. And the important thing here is that this gang was a tight-knit, highly organized group with laws, compulsory attendance at meetings, compulsory reporting of gang activities back to its hierarchy, sharing of information. Rodriguez and Hernandez were both aware of the free enterprise rule of the gang. In fact, Rodriguez is recorded speaking about it. They're both aware of the CAJA, which is the financing arm of the gang. And, of course, the CAJA is critical here. The CAJA, that is basically the gang's account, was financed, the testimony showed, by dealing drugs. The CAJA was used to purchase weapons and other narcotics to continue selling them to buy more weapons. The weapons are used to carry out the gang's mission of shooting and killing opposition gang members. The evidence showed, and the jury was entitled to believe, that no one could be a member of this gang like Rodriguez and Hernandez and not be aware of and agree to its financing itself through drug dealing.
It's my understanding that the evidence contained wiretap recordings implicating Rodriguez in some planning of hits that were ordered by the gang. That's not the case for Hernandez, or is there wiretap evidence for Hernandez as well?
I believe that the recordings on Hernandez, aside from the meetings, right, had to do with his individual attempts to buy or to obtain narcotics.
Okay.
I don't believe that Hernandez was implicated in the plot to kill John Landeros, the suspected informant, like Rodriguez was.
Okay.
So I think that the tape recordings as to Hernandez and Rodriguez, aside from the gang meetings, are on two different subjects.
Okay.
But the jury was entitled to conclude that, no, you could not be a member like Rodriguez and Hernandez and not be aware of and agree to its drug dealing. It was simply too important to the gang, used to buy drugs, bail out bond, drugs and guns, bail out members who happened to get arrested. In fact, Hernandez himself was bailed out of jail by virtue of the CAJA. He was bailed out for, I believe, a domestic battery. He wasn't at the July 2002 meeting because he was in jail on a domestic battery charge. And there was discussion in that meeting about raising the bail for Mr. Hernandez from the CAJA. With regard to Mr. Lechuga, the jury did reject his withdrawal defense and convicted him in the phase two verdict of a small drug quantity. But I think my opponent is overreading the jury's verdict in phase two. One, as to the meaning of the verdict itself, and two, as to what it permitted Judge Leinenweber to do at sentencing. there's no reason to think that the jury's verdict on phase two with regard to the below the low amount of powder cocaine that he was held responsible for, there's no reason to think that that was the only basis for conviction of Lechuga on count one in the guilt phase. Lechuga had been, he was a senior member, 20-year member of the Deuces, stated in one of the meetings that he had personally contributed some multiple thousands of dollars to the gang.
Was that serious, that comment?
I
thought we were talking about $50 a month later in that meeting.
That's the mandatory dues that were discussed in the summer of 2002. It didn't prohibit Lechuga from contributing more, of course, and he may have been tapped for other means.
Look, I haven't listened to the tape. I don't know what it sounded like, but
I haven't listened to the tape either, Chuck.
The transcripts certainly include plenty of exaggeration at times.
A lot of boasting went on.
Mm-hmm.
I take his boasting, though, to have some value. I don't know what the exact figure that he put into it, but certainly Lechuga had been a longtime member of the gang, a valued member, was aware of its goals, was aware of its organization, was aware of its members, everything that it was going to do. The things that were talked about in the summer of 2002 when he rejoined, the least that can be said is that he rejoined, were elimination of the Ambrose gang by murder, elimination of other gang members by murder, purchasing of guns, dealing of drugs, so on and so forth. So the jury's verdict, the jury may have limited its verdict in phase two as to the drug quantity for Lechuga without necessarily limiting its conviction of him on count one, the RICO conspiracy, to his half-ounce purchase, of attempted half-ounce purchase of cocaine in the summer of 2002. We don't know. But there's certainly no basis for limiting what Judge Leinenweber was able to do at sentencing and holding Lechuga accountable for his involvement in the gang, for things that were foreseeable to him, and for what was within the scope of his agreement after he rejoined, even if the jury had acquitted him of other involvement in the RICO conspiracy by virtue of its limited drug quantity finding in phase two. In other words, the jury verdict on phase two did not necessarily define for Judge Leinenweber at sentencing the scope of Mr. Lechuga's involvement in this criminal conspiracy. With regard to Harold Crowder, the district court did not abuse its discretion in including Harold Crowder in this trial and not severing him from this trial. The evidence against Mr. Crowder, Mr. Crowder was involved with the gang, was a shooter for the gang, was not necessarily a member of the gang, but was a member with privileges, as a somewhat different member from the others. He was a member by virtue of his proficiency at murder, essentially. And he was excused from some of the other requirements imposed on other insane juice gang members. It was not an abuse of discretion to include Mr. Crowder in this trial. There was evidence, of course, at this trial, as well as the other trial, the Delatorre Benave trial. There was evidence at the Harold Crowder, Mariano Morales, Lionel Lechuga trial of murders committed by others, plots to kill John Landeros, the murder of David Lascano, the murder of David Morales. There was plenty of violence proven at the second trial that Mr. Crowder was not necessarily involved in, that would, unlike his argument here today, he was, I believe, arguing that his violence alone stood out at the second trial because of the relative pacificity of the other defendants at the second trial. And just, that's just not true. There was the defendants at the second trial were equally as murderous as Harold Crowder, and he didn't stand out.
Well, that would be a strange sort of legal rule to establish anyway, that in the prior trial he sort of blended in, and in the latter trial he stood out, and therefore he should have been severed from the latter trial.
Right.
That's as a legal rule, that just is
and it certainly didn't it certainly didn't compel the judge to sever him. It's an odd way of looking at it, that's for sure. With regard to Rommel Handley, I believe the only argument raised was a sentencing argument. And with Rommel Handley, the district court, and I tried to set this out in our brief in some detail, but the district court did make a finding that he was being held accountable for actions that were both foreseeable to him and that were within the scope of his agreement. The exact language that the district court used was within his agreement with the gang. Now, that finding was not clearly erroneous. Rommel Handley was a longtime member of the gang. He said the evidence was introduced that he had been a deuce. He told police this, that he had been a deuce his whole life. He was, by the time of the summer of 2002, he was the enforcer, the shorty enforcer, which is he was the enforcer for the junior division of the gang, the younger members. But keep in mind that the younger members of the gang were the ones most actively involved in the actual shootings, murders, attempted murders, and so on in Aurora and the western suburbs. The evidence was that, and I believe I provided citations for this in our brief, that Handley had provided weapons for shorty missions, had been personally involved in three attempted murders. One that Becerra testified about, one that Osorio testified about, and one that Mr. Del Torre talked about to Rivera and was recorded on audio tape. Because of Mr. Handley's intimate involvement with the gang and with the violence committed by the gang, his own direct involvement, his involvement as the shorty enforcer, sending people on missions, and so on, it's not clearly erroneous for the judge to have found that the other violent acts by gang members were both foreseeable to him and within the scope of his agreement. So for all these reasons, we ask that the court affirm the judgment and sentences of the district court.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Nash, you're out of time, but you can have a minute.
Thank you, Judge. In answer to your question about Rule 606, Judge Sykes, I did look at the rule, and it talks about inquiry into the jury's deliberations. That is precisely what we did not want.
It's been interpreted to apply to any internal matter, as opposed to external influences on the jury's verdict. And so it's been interpreted very expansively to foreclose any inquiry into internal influences on the jury's verdict, whether or not they occurred during deliberations. It seems to me, even if it were more narrowly interpreted, that premature deliberations would necessarily be within a more narrow interpretation of the rule.
There are several cases that talk about it not being applied inflexibility to rare cases. And I would say that in this case, remember that the jury's deliberations were not over. Following this note about premature discussions, the judge sent them out again to determine the Apprendi issues. I would also suggest that the government clearly doesn't take the view that 606B prohibits any inquiry regarding wrong influences in the jury room. They didn't argue it in the district court, and although they characterize this as extraneous, as inquiries into deliberations. That was not the case. The other thing the government says is we don't. There's no indication what those discussions were. That's the point. We don't know, and there should have been an inquiry. Thank you.
Mr. Camarillo? We'll give you a minute as well.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, during my opening argument, I brought up the issue of the district court erroneously admitting evidence that Mr. Morales had been in and out of prison previously for drug-related offenses. The government seems to have conceded that that was error, and now they're suggesting that it was harmless error. The government suggests it was insignificant because it was only one statement that Mr. Morales had been in prison for cannabis distribution. That's actually not correct. The actual testimony was that Mr. Morales had been in and out of prison for narcotics offenses, and that Mr. Morales had been in prison for cannabis offense. Therefore, the government let the jury know that Mr. Morales had been in and out of prison at least three times for the very same actions that he was charged with in this offense. Significantly, the jury could not have relied on eyewitness testimony that Mr. Morales had distributed controlled substances to a witness, or that a witness saw Mr. Morales distribute controlled substance to them. So they had to rely on something other than that, and I would submit that they relied on this illegal evidence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Garz? You're also out of time, but I'll give you a minute as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just to highlight, the government is talking about mere association, awareness of free enterprise, awareness of the CAHA. Again, Taylor, 2010, said that these things do not provide evidence that you have joined a conspiracy. I understand the government's argument as far as you joined you're part of the RICO conspiracy, therefore you're automatically a part of the drug conspiracy, but we would submit that that is incorrect, that you have to prove that agreement as to the drug conspiracy itself, and you have to show that intent to possess possess with the intent to distribute the drugs, that the evidence for the conspiracy, the RICO conspiracy, does not provide the evidence to possess with intent to distribute actual drugs itself. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Garz. Mr. Chickie?
One, I would join in Ms. Garth's comments. I think they accurately and excellently sum up what's going on. And the other thing, one of the points the government made is that once you were in this gang, going to meetings, paying fees, dues, was compulsory at fear of being violated, being beaten, shot, killed yourself. So merely being in the gang doesn't show agreement. It may say you know what's going on, you have some inkling of what people are doing, but the fact that there is this compulsory nature of involvement and the risk of being violated goes against this concept of mere membership being enough to find scope of agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Ruffo? Mr. Ruffo, you have a minute.
The government argued that the jury verdict with regard to Mr. Lechuga of a lower drug amount, the less than 500 grams of cocaine, doesn't limit the judge's discretion at sentencing to define the scope of his agreement, which is undoubtedly true. However, the government overlooks that the district court also agreed with the jury and limited the amount of drugs that Mr. Lechuga was accountable for to the 1/2 ounce of cocaine that he attempted to obtain and between the two meetings. That's the scope of his agreement. There's no violence related to the scope of that agreement, and his accountability should have been limited to no violent act as opposed to all violent acts, and therefore remand is appropriate for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Omar?
Thank you. Just briefly, Your Honor, I would just add that our argument, yes, is a bit unorthodox, but our position is that it's nonetheless sound under the law. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Brindley? You as well get the requisite minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court's finding at sentencing regarding Mr. Hanley's agreement in this case was in part encapsulated by the phrase from the court, well, where there's this much smoke, there must be a little fire. That is far from a specific factual finding about the scope of his agreement, especially when at sentencing the district court actually agreed that Akeem Horton had credibly testified that in 2002 this order was issued for his failure to participate. And so we needed some sort of factual finding about what part of this he was agreeing to and which acts about which he may have been aware would fall within that part. And that's what's missing here. The government mentioned his holding this position as enforcer in its argument here. The problem with that is, of course, as noted in the briefing and throughout the record, he was failing to do what he was supposed to do as enforcer. That's why this order had been issued. That's why there were questions asked about whether he was doing what he was supposed to do. And that's why for him it's so important to have a factual finding as to what the scope of his particular agreement was in light of those unique facts. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.